When we reincarnate into a new body, the soul's character is united with the temperament of its host to form one persona. The body is the outward manifestation of the soul, but it is not the total embodiment of our soul self. Souls who come to Earth think of themselves as becoming masked actors on a world stage. In Shakespeare's Macbeth, the king prepares for death by telling us, "Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is her no more." In some ways, this famous line describes how souls feel about their lives on Earth, the difference being that once the play has begun, most of us don't know we are in a play until it's over, due to a variety of amnesiac blocks. Thus, the analogy of a play, like that of a schoolroom, befits what my clients see in a deep hypnotic trance state. I have had clients tell me that when they return to their soul groups after a particularly hard life, there is clapping and shouts of bravo from their friends. The applause is for a job well done at the end of the last act of the play of life. One subject said, "In my group, the major cast members of our last play in life will go off in a corner to study the individual scenes we played after it has ended and before rehearsals begin for the next play to come." I often hear my subjects laugh about being offered a certain part in the next play, which is their current life, and the debates that took place before final casting decisions were made as to who would play what part in the future. Our guides become stage directors who go over past life scenes with us, frame by frame, of both good and bad times. Errors in judgment are presented in small bites. All possible outcomes are studied and compared by designing new scripts for these scenes with different sets of choices that could have been made in each circumstance. Behavioral patterns are minutely dissected with each player, followed by a review of all the roles in the script. Souls might then decide to switch roles with each other and replay key scenes all over again to test the results with a different actor from their group or by someone recruited from a nearby group. I encourage my subjects to tell me about these role substitutions. Souls gain perspective from being witnesses to their own past performance through other actors. Recreations of past life alternatives present a psychodrama one finds useful as a therapeutic tool in a soul's current life. These stage analogies by soul groups do not trivialize what they go through on Earth as simple impersonations. They offer the soul an objective means of comprehension and foster a desire to improve. The system is ingenious. Souls never seem to get bored in these educational exercises, which invite creativity, originality, and a desire to triumph over adversity by acquiring wisdom from human relationships. Always, they want to do better next time. Whatever the format, spaces of learning provide a fascinating chessboard for souls when they go over all the possible moves for the best solutions after the game is over. Indeed, some of my subjects call the whole process of reincarnation the game. The outcome of one's performance in the play may range from very satisfactory to acceptable to unsatisfactory. I realize some readers might conclude this sounds suspiciously like educational grading on Earth. But this is not an idea of my origination. I'm told that in soul groups, the evaluation of performance by our peers is not threatening, rather, it encourages motivation. Most souls appear to me to be driven by a desire to review the last game of life they have played in order to better preview the next one. Like champion athletes, they want to try and improve with each performance. Ultimately, they know at a certain level of development and proficiency this aspect of the game will end with the closing of the play and their physical incarnations. This is the goal of souls who come to Earth. As I stated at the beginning of this section, instruction in learning centers is not limited to reviewing past lives. Besides all the other activities, energy manipulation is a major part of training. The acquiring of these skills takes many forms in classroom work. I have said before that humor is a hallmark of the spirit world. The student in the next case gives us a sense of the whimsical when she explains how one of her creation classes got a little out of hand. Case 35, Dr. N, you have explained about how your group has gathered into an enclosure resembling a school classroom, but I'm not sure what is going on here. S, we have gathered for practice in creation training with our energy. My guide, Trinity, is standing at a chalkboard working on a drawing for us to study. Dr. N, and what are you doing now? S, sitting at my desk with the others, watching Trinity. Dr. N, give me a picture of this. Are you lined up in a row with the others at a long desk, or what? S, no, we have our individual desks, they have tops which open up. Dr. N, where are you sitting in relation to your friends? S, I am off to the left. Kel, the mischievous one, my subject's brother in her current life, is next to me. Jack, subject's current husband, is just in back of me. Dr. N, what is the mood in this room right now? S, laid back, very relaxed, because this assignment is so easy it's almost boring, watching Trinity drawing. Dr. N, oh, really? What is Trinity drawing? S, he is drawing, how to make a mouse quickly, from different energy parts. Dr. N, are you going to break up into groups to combine your energy with others for this assignment? S, with a wave of her hand, oh, no. We are way past that. We will be tested individually. Dr. N, please explain the test. S, we are to rapidly visualize a mouse in our minds, as to the necessary energy parts to create a whole mouse. There is an order of progression with how energy should be arranged in any creation. Dr. N, so the test is the proper steps in creating a mouse? S, yes, but, actually, this is a test of speed. The secret of efficiency in creation training is rapid conceptualization, knowing which part of the animal to start with first. Then you tackle the amount of energy to be applied. Dr. N, this sounds difficult. S, with a big grin, it's easy. Trinity should have picked a more complex creature. Dr. N, doggedly, well, it seems to me that Trinity knows what he is doing. I don't see, cuts me off with gales of laughter and I ask what is going on. S, Kel has just twinked at me and opened his desktop and I see a white mouse scurrying out. Dr. N, meaning he is getting ahead of the assignment? S, yes, and showing off. Dr. N, is Trinity aware of all this? S, still laughing, of course, he misses nothing. He just stops and says, all right, let's all do this quickly if you are so ready to begin. Dr. N, then what happens? S, there are mice running all over the room, giggles, I put larger than normal ears on mine just for fun to liven things up even more. I will close this section with a more serious case example of group energy usage. It represents a type of lesson I have not reported on before. Case 36 involves an inner circle of three companions who wish to help a fourth member who has just incarnated on Earth. Unlike the higher level of soul capability in the previous case, these souls are part of a learning group that has recently entered level 2. Case 36, Dr. N, as your mind visualizes all the meaningful activities going on in your study group, please take me to a significant exercise and explain what you are doing. S. Long pause, oh, you want that? Well, my two friends and I are doing our best to help Clyde with positive energy after he entered the body of a baby. We want this to work because soon we are all going to follow him into life. Dr. N, let's go slowly here. What exactly are the three of you doing at this moment? S, takes a deep breath. We are sitting together in a circle, our teacher is in back of us directing things. We are sending a united beam of energy down into the mind of Clyde's child. He has just arrived and well, I don't want to violate confidences, but he is not having an easy time. Dr. N, I see, well, perhaps talking about it might clarify things. Don't you think it would be all right to discuss what you are doing a little further? S, I guess so, I don't see the harm. Dr. N, gently, tell me what month after conception did Clyde join the baby? S, in the fourth month, pauses and then adds, but we started to help Clyde in his sixth month. It is such hard work to continue to the ninth month. Dr. N, I can understand that, the necessary concentration and all. Pause, tell me why Clyde needs help from the three of you. S, We are trying to send him encouraging energy shaped in such a way to assist Clyde A in making a better adjustment to the temperament of this child. When you join with a baby, it should be like placing your hand into a glove which is the exact size for you and the child. Clyde A's glove is not fitting well this time. Dr. N, does this knowledge come as a surprise to you and your teacher? S.R., not really. You see, Clyde A is a quiet soul, peaceful, and this baby has a restless, aggressive mind, and the mesh is difficult for Clyde A, even though he knew what to expect. Dr. N, are you saying he wanted a certain kind of challenge before this baby was chosen? S. Yes, he knew he needed to learn to cope with this sort of body because he has had trouble before with not being able to control aggression. Dr. N, is this child going to be a hostile person? Perhaps one with few inhibitions, emotional conflicts and so forth. S. laughs, you got it, that's my older brother. Dr. N, in your current life, you mean? S. yes. Dr. N, what roles will the other two souls you are working with at the moment assume in Clyde A's life, besides yourself? S. Zynine is his wife and Mont's, his best friend. Dr. N, sounds like a good support team. Can you explain a bit more why Clyde A needs this sort of type A personality in a body? S. Well, Clyde A is very thoughtful. He ponders a lot and is tentative. He doesn't jump into situations. It was felt this body would help him expand his capabilities and assist the child, too. Dr. N, was Clyde A's last life a problem? S. shrugs. Problems, the same sort of body, he was caught up in obsessions and addictions, little control. He abused Zynine too. Dr. N, then why? S. breaking in, we really studied that last life, reviewing everything over and over. Clyde A wanted another chance in the same kind of body. He asked Zynine if she would be his wife again and she agreed. Subject begins laughing. Dr. N, what amuses you? S. Only this time I'm going along as his younger brother to help keep him in line with a very strong body. Dr. N, let's finish with your current energy beam exercise. Explain how you and your two companions use your energy in helping Clyde A. S. Long pause, the alignments of Clyde A's energy and that of the baby are scattered. Dr. N, the baby has scattered emotional energy and Clyde A is having trouble melding with that? S. Yes. Dr. N, does this involve the patterns of electrical impulses from the brain, or what? S. pause. Yes, the thought processes, from nerve endings, stops and then continues. We are trying to help Clyde A in tracking this. Dr. N, is the baby resisting Clyde A as an intruder? S. No, I don't think so, laughs. But Clyde A thinks he got another primitive brain in some respects. Dr. N, where in the baby's body is your combined energy beam going? S. We are being directed to work up from the base of the skull, starting at the back of the neck. Dr. N, I bring client into the past tense. Were you successful in this exercise? S. I think we did help Clyde A, especially in the beginning, laughs again. But my brother is still a headstrong person in this life. Additional illustrations of soul group interaction will be cited in later chapters. In chapter 9, under the section describing the body-soul partnership, I will go into more detail about the physiological aspects of our struggle with the primitive side of the human mind mentioned in the last case. The next chapter is devoted to the higher spiritual assistance we receive as an adjunct to soul study groups. The psychological ramifications of future life choices actually start with our first orientation upon returning to the spirit world. Ideas involving past performance and future expectations are brought into sharper focus with the soul's first council meeting, the Council of Elders, human fear of judgment and punishment. Not long after souls return to their spirit groups, they are called before a gathering of wise beings. A step or two above our guides, these ascended masters are the most advanced identifiable entities my still incarnating clients see in the spirit world. They give them different names such as the Old Ones, the Sacred Masters, the Venerables, and pragmatic titles like the Examiners or the Committee. The two most common names I hear to describe these highly evolved masters are Council and Elders, so I use these designations to describe this body. Because the Council of Elders does represent authority in the spirit world. There are people at my lectures who immediately become suspicious when I talk about robed beings who wish to question souls about their past life performance. One man in Toronto couldn't contain himself and loudly proclaimed to everyone in the audience, "Aha, I knew it! A courtroom, judges, punishment. Where does this fear and cynicism about the afterlife come from in the minds of so many people? Religious institutions, civil courts and military tribunals give us codes of morality and justice which impact the conduct of millions. There is crime and punishment and cultural traditions of harsh judgment for human transgressions that have been with us since our tribal days. The positive effects of a code of behavior and ethics connected to all religions down through history have been enormous. It has been argued that fear of divine retribution is what keeps the masses at bay with better conduct than they would otherwise have. Nevertheless, I feel there is a downside to any religious doctrine that creates personal anguish over facing a harsh final authority and maleficent spirits after death. Organized religions have only been with us within the last 5,000 years. Anthropologists tell us that in the millennia before, primal people were naturists who believed all animate and inanimate things had good and bad spirits. In this respect, the old tribal practices were not so different from the idolatry of historical religions. Many gods of old were wrathful and unforgiving, while others were benevolent and helpful. Human beings have always been uneasy about forces beyond their control, particularly with divinities who might rule their lives after death. Since fears about survival have always been a part of our lives, it follows that human beings would find death to be the ultimate danger. Throughout our long history, the brutality of life meant that judgment, punishment and suffering would likely continue in some way after death. Many cultures around the world have fostered these beliefs for their own purposes. People were led to believe that all souls, good and bad, would pass through a dark underworld of danger and trial right after death. In the West, purgatory has long been pictured as a lonely way station for souls trapped between heaven and hell. In recent decades, the non-evangelical churches have a more liberal definition of purgatory as a state of isolation for the purification of sins and imperfections before the soul can enter heaven. With Eastern philosophy, especially among the canons of Hinduism and the Mahayana Buddhist sects, there has been a long tradition of spiritual prisons of lower, defiled planes of existence, which is also being liberalized. This concept is another reason why I am against the use of concentric circle imagery of multiple astral planes as a map for describing soul travel after death. Historically, they were designed to show multipurgatorial cells in an underworld of judges, courts and demons. Seekers of truth who turn to the ancient metaphysical traditions of the East find a confusing mix of superstitions, just as with Western theology. While reincarnation has long been embraced by the East, there has been the retention of the doctrine of transmigration. In my travels through India, I found transmigration to be an intimidating concept which has been used to control behavior. Under this credo, a wide variety of sins are met with the very real possibility of the soul being transmigrated back to a lower subhuman form of life in its next cycle of existence. In my research, I have found no evidence to support transmigration of souls. My subjects indicate the soul energy of different forms of life on Earth do not appear to intermingle their energy in the spirit world. For me, the intimidation and fear transmigration engenders is a coercion of karmic justice. I have found the souls of humans on other worlds in prior incarnations to be in host bodies slightly more or less intelligent than our own species. I have never had a client assigned to another world where they were not the most dominant intelligence on that particular planet. This is by design. Rather than stages of punishment, we go through stages of self-enlightenment. Yet large segments of human society are unable to shake off the nagging feeling, built over thousands of years of cultural conditioning, that judgment and punishment must exist in some form in the afterlife as it does on earth. Maybe it won't be a hell with torture by the forces of darkness, but it's something unpleasant. It is my hope that what I have to say in this chapter will bring comfort to people inclined to be fearful about the possibility of punishment after death. On the other hand, there will be those who feel accountability to a council of elders may not be all that comfortable either. The Epicureanists of this world, those devoted solely to uninhibited pleasure in life while paying little attention to the plight of others, might also not be happy with this chapter. Neither will the iconoclasts, who are opposed to authority of any kind, moral or otherwise. The spirit world is a place of order and the Council of Elders exemplifies justice. They are not the ultimate source of divine authority, but they appear to represent the last station of beings responsible for souls still incarnating on earth. These wise beings have great compassion for human weakness and they demonstrate infinite patience with our faults. We will be given many second chances in future lives. They won't be lives of easy karmic choices, otherwise we would learn nothing by coming to Earth. However, the risks of life and sanity on this planet are not designed to cause us any further pain after death. The setting for soul evaluation, my subjects state they appear before their council right after an incarnation and many report they will visit them a second time just before rebirth. Of the two assemblages, the first seems to have the most impact on the soul. During this meeting, the major choices we made in the life just lived are reviewed with us. Behavior and accountability for our actions at important forks in our karmic path are evaluated carefully. At the first conference we are acutely aware of our mistakes, especially if we have hurt others. If there is to be a second visit as the time draws close for reincarnation, it is more relaxed with discussions centering around potential life choices, opportunities and expectations for the future. Our guides notify us when it is time to go before the council and usually they will escort us to the chambers of these ascended masters. To the average client, guides don't appear to play a large role at these hearings. However, when a more advanced soul tells me they go to this meeting alone, it is not unusual for them to see their guide sitting on the council while they are there. When our guides do appear with us in front of the council, they are rather quiet. This is because behind-the-scenes discussions about our last life have already taken place between guides and council members. As our primary teacher and advocate, guides may want to interject a thought for our clarification, or interpret some concept for us if they think we are confused at any point during the proceedings. It is my feeling that guides do far more at these hearings than many of my clients realize. The descriptions about the form and procedure of council meetings are very consistent among all hypnosis subjects. When I begin this part of a client's session, my usual approach is to ask them what happens when the time arrives to go before a group of wise beings. Here is an example of a typical response: the time of my expectation has arrived. I am to see the Holy Ones. My guide, Linil, comes and escorts me from my cluster group down a long corridor past other classrooms. We move into another area with a larger hallway that is lined with marble columns. The walls are textured with what looks to be frosted glass panels of many colors. I hear soft choir music and string instruments. The light is a subdued, golden tone. Everything is so relaxing, even sensual, but I am a little apprehensive. We come to an atrium filled with beautiful plants and a bubbling fountain of water. This is the waiting area. After a few moments, Linil takes me into a round room with a high domed ceiling. There are rays of light shining down. The Holy Ones are seated at a long crescent-shaped table. I move to the center of the room in front of the table while Linil stands behind me to my left. When one first heard about the council meetings, I wondered why it was necessary for them to be seen in any sort of authoritarian setting. Why not a simple countryside scene, if they are so full of benevolence? While the younger souls told me that this setting was right and proper for their examinations, the older souls explained that there was a major reason for a domed enclosure. With this design, A higher presence effectively focuses its light energy on the entire proceedings from above. I will discuss the powerful impact of this presence later in this chapter. A great majority of my subjects visualize a dome design for the chamber of the Council of Elders, as shown in Figure 8. They see the chamber structure as a manifestation of a holy place on Earth. This celestial shell of compassion, as one client called his council chamber, is symbolic of temples, mosques, synagogues and churches. Figure 8 shows the central table, D, which is usually long in front and may curve around at the edges to accommodate larger numbers of elders. Some clients report that they see this table on a slightly raised dais just above eye level. I have learned these nuances in setting relate to what the soul feels is necessary for a particular meeting to be most effective for them. If a soul sees its council in more of an authority mode, there might be reasons for this which I will then probe with a client about the life just lived. Subjects who are regressed to the spirit world do not readily volunteer details about the scope of a specific inquiry from the elders. They must feel comfortable that the hypnosis facilitator knows their way around the council chamber. On an unconscious level, this confidence in the spiritual regressionist seems to give them mental permission to speak about their sacred memories. This is the reason why my research into human memory of the spirit world took so many years. It was like fitting the pieces of a jigsaw puzzle together. Small pieces of information about the spirit world led to larger implications which would never have occurred to me to ask about in a whole context. For instance, the reason behind a raised dais in the council chamber was one small detail that expanded into a larger meaning. Another was the position of a client's guide, particularly at the first hearing. As can be seen in Figure 8, the position of the guide, C, in this illustration is on the left. For a long time I did not understand why guides were usually positioned behind and to the left of most of my clients being questioned. If the soul has two guides, occasionally the junior guide will enter the room and stand on the right side. Most of the time we have just our senior guide in attendance and only a low percentage of my subjects tell me this guide stands on the right. Whenever I asked why this was so, I received rather vague answers such as, "Oh, it is less restrictive or it is customary for our communication or we all stand in certain places out of respect." For a long time I simply stopped asking this question. Then came the day when I was working with a very perceptive advanced subject who told me about the importance of distinguishing all council communication. I revived my question about guide position and received this answer. Figure 8, the council chamber, a typical structural design where elders meet souls. This spacious room appears to most people as a large rotunda with a dome ceiling. Souls enter the chamber at the end of hallway, A, or from an alcove. The soul is positioned in the center, B, with their guide in back, usually on the left, C. The elders generally sit at a long crescent-shaped table, D, in front of the soul. The table may appear to be rectangular. Case 37, Dr. N, why is your guide standing behind you on the left? S, laughs, don't you know? With most human bodies the right side of the head is not as predominant as the left. Dr. N, what does that have to do with his position? S, the left side or right side thing, not in sync. Dr. N, are you talking about an imbalance between the left and right brain hemispheres in humans? S, yes, my problem, and that of many others recently returned from Earth, is a slight weakness of energy reception on our left side. It doesn't last too long. Dr. N, and, as you stand in front of the council, you are still feeling the effects of your human body? You still have that physical imprint with you? S, yeah, that's what I am telling you. We don't shake off these effects by the time of our first council meeting. It seems like only a few hours since my death. It takes a while for us to get rid of the density of the physical body, the constrictions of it, before we are completely free. This is one reason why I don't need Jerome, guide, so much at the second meeting. Dr. N, because? S, by then, we are sending and receiving telepathic communication more efficiently. Dr. N, please explain to me what Jerome actually does to help you by standing on your left side. S, in most humans the left side is more rigid than the right. Jerome assists in the energy reception coming into my right side from the council by blocking thoughts which might escape out the left.